Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Keith Krueger, one of the Intellectual History Channel hosts, and today we're very fortunate to be joined by Eric McGillivray, professor of political science at The Ohio State University. Professor McGillivray's research and teaching interests focus on modern and contemporary political thought, with an emphasis on liberal, republican, and democratic theory, as well as the pragmatic philosophical tradition. His scholarly journal articles have appeared in the American Journal of Political Science, the Journal of Political Philosophy, Political Theory, and Social Philosophy and Policy, among others. His first book was published in 2004, Reconstructing Public Reason, which was followed in 2011 by The Invention of Market Freedom. But he joins us today to talk primarily about his latest, Liberal Freedom, Pluralism, Polarization and Politics, published this year by Cambridge University Press. The professor's latest book is relevant, clearly argued, and well supported. His engaging narrative will appeal to a broad cross-section of NBN listeners across the disciplines, which seems fitting for the work of a wide-ranging political theorist interested in the applicability of ideas and the American pragmatic tradition. Professor McGillivray, Eric, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today about your writing and research.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, and thanks for that generous introduction.
Eric, finally, good to talk with you. Let me start by asking you to share a bit about your scholarly influences and how you came to study political theory.
Oh, gosh, I came to study political theory kind of by accident. I took a course as an undergraduate. One of these cases where a course had been canceled, I'd pick something up at the last minute, and I took an ancient medieval political thought class with Professor George Kateb, who was just an incredibly charismatic and wise instructor who became my undergraduate advisor. And that sort of began a journey, which led me to where I am today, that sort of initial chance encounter with the course catalog.
Well, do you see yourself, Eric, more as political scientist, political theorist, or intellectual historian?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I was trained by a philosopher really in graduate school. And so I think of myself as a political theorist of a kind of analytical bent. I think whatever added value I bring to the study of politics comes from that set of skills. Intellectual history was something I came to actually rather late as a scholar anyway. I started to write a book about freedom about 15 years ago and was going to write a book about the ideas of the philosopher Philip Pettit, who I thought had a very interesting account of freedom as non-domination, but who I didn't think I had a very good account of how markets fit into that picture of freedom as non-domination. And so I started writing a kind of, you know, analytical book about non-domination and markets. And there was a kind of line of argument that Pettit had that explained to his satisfaction what happened to Republican freedom, so to speak, in the 19th century, such that it became an idea that one had to recover and kind of reintroduce to contemporary audiences. And I thought Pettit's story about why Republican freedom had died off wasn't a very good story. And so I thought maybe an early chapter in the book would be explaining why I thought that story wasn't good. And so I thought I'd put a section in an early chapter telling my version of the story. And that section grew into two sections. And then that section grew into three sections. And then it became a chapter and then two chapters. And eventually I realized this is the book. The book is going to be this historical story about the emergence of market freedom in the modern period, and that became the book you mentioned before, The Invention of Market Freedom. And much to my surprise, I had written a book about intellectual history, which is not something I ever thought I would do or that I was particularly trained to do, but I just learned an enormous amount doing it. And then when I came to write the book that I intended to write in the first place, which is the book that we're talking about today, I had that new set of tools, that new set of historical perspectives and influences to kind of guide me through this, this set of ideas.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, and you kind of preempt some of the next question I really wanted to ask, because I was going to say or ask, Liberal Freedom is the third book. As mentioned, Reconstructing Public Reason was the first. And as you just explained, The Invention of Market Freedom, your second, is really important in terms of your own development as a scholar. What are some of the intellectual threads you've been weaving throughout all three of the books?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in the idea of freedom and what it means to be a free person and to live in a free society. And I guess I would say the two questions that I'm a pragmatist, as you mentioned, so I think about things in terms of puzzles or problems that motivate somebody to study something or to think about something. And I guess the two puzzles that motivated the second and third books respectively were, first of all, how did the market go from being a place where a person was paradigmatically unfree to being a place where a person is paradigmatically free? That's a kind of 180-degree shift in thinking about markets that happened sometime in the early modern period. Really interesting puzzle. Second puzzle is, how did liberalism, which was an ideology that started, this is really the central puzzle of the current book, how did liberalism, which is an ideology that had its origins as a matter of ideological label in the early 19th century, come to be understood as an ideology that started in the 17th century with someone like John Locke and the social contract theorists? How did that kind of historical shift in the understanding of what liberalism stands for, what it means, both by liberals themselves and by their critics, take place? And really, one of the central themes of liberal freedom is that we fundamentally misunderstand liberalism if we don't understand that it's a product of the 19th century and not of the 17th century.
Well, you've touched on some of this already, but before we leave your earlier work, particularly The Invention of Market Freedom, it contrasts the market conception of freedom with the Republican notion it replaced. This is important to your argument in Liberal Freedom. Can you talk a bit about how the value of freedom became linked with the market as an institution, and why is it important to understand market freedom as an invention?
Yeah, so the two features of markets that made them seem like sort of freedom-threatening institutions prior to the modern period were, on the one hand, the fact that markets involved you in activities that were thought to be threatening to individual virtue. So money-making, competition, trades, not the sort of loftier pursuits that a free gentleman was supposed to be engaged in. That's on the one hand. And on the other hand, the fact that markets make us constitutively vulnerable. To be in a market is to be uncertain about what's going to happen. And a sort of central feature of the idea of Republican freedom is this idea of control, collective control over social outcomes. So on both of those dimensions, markets were thought to be a kind of threat to Republican freedom. And then the pivot that happens kind of in the second half of the 18th century is this sort of, on the one hand, a kind of idea that there's a kind of virtue that can be realized in markets, virtues of, this is kind of the Ben Franklin idea, virtues of frugality and industry and prudence and thinking about things from your trading partner's perspective. And then also that markets themselves can serve as a kind of check on what might otherwise be the unlimited power of the state. So markets come to play this kind of Republican-friendly role in the minds of certain thinkers in the second half of the 18th century. And so there's this kind of interesting split that happens in the Republican tradition in the second half of the 18th century between kind of pro-market thinkers like David Hume and Adam Smith and sort of market skeptical thinkers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and the sort of instability of that, of the Republican tradition as a result of that split, gives rise to this new idea of market freedom as being sort of its own thing. That's the kind of pivot that I see happening again in sort of the early modern period prior to the emergence of liberalism, which is something that happens, as I said before, in the 19th century.
Well, your latest book, clearly brings to bear some weighty topics that you laid the groundwork for previously, as just mentioned. You bookend, so to speak, liberal freedom with a prologue and conclusion that includes a series of vignettes, descriptions of moments in which individuals sense their actual freedom to choose to be spontaneous. And you lay out your rationale, which argues that these moments are, and I quote, what we think about what freedom means as a political value. Can you talk a bit about how you came to the idea of the vignettes and why they're useful as representing moments of freedom in terms of political values?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. It's interesting. I mean, the vignettes are sort of literary in a way, and it was a kind of writing experiment for me to try to write something that had a kind of more of a literary quality. I tried to put just enough detail into the vignettes that you could sort of imagine the scene, and then not quite enough detail that you couldn't put yourself into the scene, that sort of enough left vague that you could imagine it as a reader, you can imagine it as you like. But the idea of the preface, right, is to kind of prime intuitions about what freedom can mean on both of the dimensions that I'm talking about. So the kind of central claim of the book is that freedom means, or freedom requires, on the one hand, creating the social conditions under which people can properly be held responsible for what they do. So people aren't subject to things like ignorance or poverty or domination, which can kind of compromise our agency and our ability to be held responsible. That's what I call Republican freedom. And then on the other hand, freedom means carving out a space, a social space, within which we aren't held responsible for what we do, within which we're non-responsible, as I put it, within which we're able to do things that have consequences for other people that we aren't publicly held accountable for. And that's what I call market freedom. And so really the preface is trying, before I even get to that argument, is trying to prime people's intuitions about how those freedoms fit together, sort of how they complement and how they challenge each other. So the first vignette is about driving down the highway on a road trip that has no sort of set destination, a kind of paradigmatically, maybe a paradigmatically American way of thinking about freedom. Other vignettes talk about receiving a random direct message in the middle of the night and deciding whether to respond, deciding to immigrate to another country, being a trader in a kind of financial exchange, these sort of moments where possibility and uncertainty and sort of starting anew are central themes. And then each vignette is paired with a kind of second half, which shows how that kind of freedom can either literally or figuratively spin out of control. So there's a car accident, or the market crashes that the person is trading on, or the fact of immigration gives rise to political unrest in the country people are immigrating to. And that is meant to get across this kind of two-faced notion of freedom that I'm working with throughout the book. On the one hand, this notion of individual possibility and sort of setting one's own terms. And on the other hand, the social infrastructure that makes that kind of action possible and that kind of is called into action when the more market freedom, non-responsible freedom spins out of control.
You talk a bit about the tension between the demand for control and the spirit of spontaneity and this negotiation of boundaries. I found that interesting between the political and the non-political, this public-private divide. So this is the politics that you're setting out to defend. And it's interesting in a way to set it all up this way. And as you said, in a literary way, it does have a kind of a theatricality to it.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you feel that way. And then what I do in the conclusion of the book is sort of come back to those vignettes. I mean, really the aim of the book is to provide a vocabulary. This is what I think liberalism does, provide a vocabulary for talking about moral and political disagreements, where because everybody recognizes we're striking a balance between these two competing values, even when we disagree, we can nevertheless see in the person we disagree with a set of values that in some sense we also endorse as a kind of commonality to it. And so the conclusion comes back to the vignettes and casts them each as a kind of political conversation between two or more interlocutors who are implicitly using the ideas of freedom that I've talked about throughout the book to think about the kind of spinning out of control aspects of each of the vignettes that appear in the preface. So it's meant to kind of illustrate how political dialogue might go in this kind of liberal framework that I've laid out. And the conversations aren't easy, and they don't come to clean resolutions, but it's meant to illustrate again how this way of thinking about politics from a liberal point of view makes it possible talk to each other across our disagreements in a way that we can find kind of mutually intelligible.
No, I think it's an effective, I'm not sure if bookending is the right word, but that seems appropriate. Well, all of this comes before the reader even gets to Liberal Freedom's introduction, which really lays out the book's premises and provides an overview of the chapter contents. You titled it by asking, why liberalism? Why freedom? It's a key part of the book that sets up the context for the broader arguments. And so just a quick mention of the first two titles to give listeners some idea of your framing. So your first subsection is the polarization problem. The second subsection is the justice paradigm. Before I ask you about the problem and the paradigm, I want to start with your epigraph to open the introduction, which comes from Lionel Trilling's 1950 collection of essays, The Liberal Imagination, which reads, a criticism which has at heart the interests of liberalism might find its most useful work not in confirming liberalism in its sense of general rightness, but in putting under some degree of pressure the liberal ideas and assumptions of the present time. Trilling's point about liberals needing to reflect on their own position for weaknesses and complacencies is more interesting, too, given the quote was Trilling's use of Mill encouraging readers to study Coleridge, who, as Trilling points out, was at odds with liberals, and I quote, all down the intellectual and political line. So I bring it up and I mention it because I found it really interesting backdrop for, well, the present time and the first section of your introduction, the problem of polarization. How do you explain the polarization problem and why is it significant to your argument concerning liberalism and freedom? You argue that we need a moral vocabulary. Can you share a bit about why this is important to overcoming the problem?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. I mean, your book was written over a period, as we all know, when political polarization really became a central and, from my point of view, deeply worrying feature of politics, not only in the United States, but really in a lot of liberal democracies. This sense of anger, mutual distrust, misunderstanding, sometimes hatred, that's really tearing or threatening to tear the fabric of a lot of liberal democracies altogether apart. So as a citizen and as a believer in liberal democracy, this is deeply concerning to me. And it seems to me that if any political ideology should be equipped to teach lessons about how one can diffuse polarization and get people to talk to each other, it should be the liberal tradition, which is founded on ideas of toleration and inclusion and dialogue and epistemic humility and all sorts of values like this that really are inimical to the idea of polarization. But then it seemed to me, and this is why I use the Trilling quote, although, of course, our context is different from his, it seemed to me that academic liberalism was part of the problem and not part of the solution. And so really what I'm trying to do in the book is to recover what I think is a truer account of what liberals have historically stood for, because I think that account can be deployed in a way that would really be constructive in our current political moment. I mean, polarization has a lot of causes. I run through some of them quickly at the beginning of the introduction. I wouldn't claim to have a kind of clean sociological account or political account of why polarization is happening. For me, as a pragmatist, the question is, how do we respond to this problem? What ideological resources can we bring to bear? And for me, as a political theorist and an intellectual historian, you know, I'm looking for resources in the history of political thought and the liberal tradition that I think could do some of that work. I don't pretend to have a complete solution, obviously, but I'd like to be part of the solution and not part of the problem, if that makes sense.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. Well, in the summer of 2021, the writer George Packer adapted an article from his book, Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. And the article was titled How America Fractured into Four Parts. People in the United States no longer agree on the nation's purpose, values, history, or meaning. Is reconciliation possible? For listeners who may have missed it or only vaguely recall its content, the article's subtitle provides the research question, so to speak. for our purposes. That is, how can people in the United States who do not agree on the nation's purpose, values, history, or meaning be reconciled? So I'm not trying to pin you down on polarization or Packer's argument here, but Packer's argument, or the article anyways, rests on four narratives that divide society into somewhat overlapping segments: Free America, Smart America, Real America, and Just America. And I realize that doesn't give listeners much to go on, so I'll put a link to the Atlantic article on the NBN webpage for this interview for those who are interested. There's a caricatured aspect to these kinds of generalizations to some extent, for sure, but Packer strikes me as an astute observer and develops his narratives quite thoroughly in the article. Eric, I know you read the Packer piece when it was published, and the details are less a concern, but I thought of it when reading your section on the problem of polarization, in part because it too highlights this inability or unwillingness to communicate honestly or fairly about politics with those whom we disagree. In other words, on one level at least, what we have here is a failure to communicate, as they say. And right. Part of your response, right, to the polarization problem, as you posted, involves reconsidering communication as a kind of sharing. Can you explain your thinking there in terms of political communication and what, if any, parallels you see with your approach in relation to Packer's question about reconciliation and his depiction of the state of American society?
So I confess that I haven't read Packer's book. I did read the Atlantic piece when it came out, and I looked it over before this conversation. My take on the article is more the statement of a problem than the proposal of a solution. What I find interesting about Packer's sort of fourfold division of American culture, political culture, is that two of the poles are ideological and two of them are cultural. So you have Free America and Just America, which, just to be even cruder than he is, you know, sort of a libertarian bent in American political culture, and then a kind of more social justice oriented bent in America. Those are kind of ideological poles of a certain kind. And then you have what he calls Smart America and Real America, which are, you know, roughly speaking, the kind of cosmopolitan, highly educated urban elite and the kind of professionals and so on. And then the kind of working class, small town, small city, non-coastal kind of Christian white culture. It strikes me that that's really a two-dimensional analysis, right? You have an ideological divide on the one hand and a cultural divide on the other. And the work my book is trying to do is to get us to see that neither of the ideologies suffices on its own. Of course, there's a place for social justice and for collective efforts to realize social justice in any liberal society. And that's going to require some kind of collective effort and some kind of collective agreement on what the aims of social justice policy would be. But of course, a society that only cared about social justice and that ignored the fact that we agree about what social justice is or what it requires would be stifling and probably in the end authoritarian. So we need to have some space in political culture for individual freedom to live one's life as one sees fit without being bound by collective decisions about what the proper aims of government ought to be or what the proper aims of individual life ought to be. So on the ideological dimension, the goal of the book, again, is to see that we're always balancing these two things against one another. We're always balancing the claims of collective responsibility for social outcomes on the one hand and the sort of space for individual non-responsibility on the other. Hopefully that makes the two ideological poles intelligible to each other. And then the harder question, of course, is the sort of cultural divide, which, how do we get, as he puts it, Smart America, Real America, to talk to each other? And, you know, it's easier to say than to do, but it requires a kind of ability to inhabit the perspective of somebody else, to think about things from their point of view, to be respectful, to respect the dignity of people who live differently and think differently and value different things than you do, which has always, of course, been a liberal value. And again, my hope, my contribution to this very hard problem, which is only a partial contribution, is that by having a moral vocabulary that everybody can sort of use and understand, will be a tool that could be used in having those kinds of conversations. It's too easy for libertarians to be utopian about markets and to say, well, anybody who doesn't get on board with this sort of project of liberty understood as a certain kind of market-centered project is just wrong, and their preferences can be overridden. The market regime can be imposed on them by fiat. And equally so, it's somebody who thinks they have the correct ideas about social justice, and anybody who disagrees with them is properly overridden or shouted down or not listened to. The same kind of pathology can exist on that side. So really an appeal to charity, to mutual intelligibility, to dialogue, that's the kind of central goal of the book.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts on that. There is, like I say, a kind of a caricatured element to that, to that article, as interesting as I think the narrative is. Here, let me move on here. This problem of polarization and or at least of language, right, as it relates to a shared vocabulary of communication, it seems to relate back to your earlier work in The Invention of Market Freedom, which in turn builds toward your explanation of liberalism, as you put it. The political ideology that holds Republican and market freedom together in a single political vision defines their respective limits and seeks to maintain a fruitful tension between them. And as you've alluded to already, I've left much out of this oversimplification here, but was hoping to provide you a prompt to help transition listeners from polarization to the next issue that frames your argument, that is what you refer to as the justice paradigm. Can you explain the importance of this section in terms of your broader argument, how it relates to language and discourse, and why liberalism is too important to be left to the Rawlsians, as you put it?
Right. So one of the central claims of the book is that there was a kind of a sea change in liberal political thought, beginning, roughly speaking, with John Rawls's seminal book, A Theory of Justice, which appears in 1971. And Rawls sets out, Rawls begins by saying that justice is, as he says, the first virtue of social institutions, and that the aim of a liberal society, maybe the necessary starting point of a liberal political philosophy, should be to identify principles of social organization that all reasonable people would accept. So this is the work that Rawls's famous original position in The Veil of Ignorance does in yielding his famous two principles of justice. And so this accomplishes two things, or two changes in liberal thought as they've been understood up to that point. The first is putting justice rather than freedom as the first virtue of social institutions. The word liberalism, of course, is derived from the word liberty. And liberals have always, up until Rawls, taken freedom to be the first virtue, freedom in this sort of complicated two-dimensional sense that I've been talking about. And on the other hand, this notion that we have to begin from a standpoint of agreement that all reasonable people would accept. Of course, nobody's ever found that point of agreement. And it's a way of approaching political philosophy that creates a sort of awkward rhetorical position where you're basically declaring anybody who disagrees with you to be sort of ipso facto unreasonable. And that seems to be a very unpromising and indeed illiberal way to think about politics. Politics, to my mind, is constitutively about disagreement about fundamental moral matters, and the question of how we work together in the face of that kind of disagreement. So the idea of starting from a standpoint of reasonable agreement, or taking that as the necessary starting point of political philosophy, seems to me non-constructive and again at odds with what the liberal tradition had been understood to be up to that point. So this is where the intellectual history becomes important. Rawls, of course, is working very self-consciously in the social contract tradition, really recovering that tradition for the 20th century after about 200 years of which it had been pretty much set aside. And so he's looking back to thinkers like Kant and Locke as the, so to speak, the real liberals. Kant and Locke, neither of whom would have called themselves liberals because the word liberal wasn't an ideological label at the time they were writing in the 17th and 18th centuries. And then sort of skipping over what's to my mind, the real liberal tradition, which starts in the early decades of the 19th century, roughly with the post-French Revolution, Benjamin Constant, people like that, and runs through people like Tocqueville, Mill, the British social liberals, John Dewey, Isaiah Berlin, and so on. That tradition sort of gets set aside in the Rawlsian framework in favor of this contractarian view, which is just anachronistic to call to call liberal, because those thinkers wouldn't have called themselves liberals. The word wasn't available to them.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting too. You mentioned some of the intellectual connections, and as you were talking, I thought of your epigraph for Iris Murdoch, and she dedicated at least one of her pieces to Stuart Hampshire, and you know, he wrote that piece called "Justice as Conflict" or "Justice is Conflict," and again, right, I suppose in the heart of what you're talking about, when justice really prevails as the moniker of choice. But let me step back a bit here. I hope I've been able to help you convey to listeners through the vignettes and whatnot just how interestingly you've laid out your book organizationally in helping to capture the interest and attention of readers. From the importance and of the opening of the vignettes in the prologue to their closure, as you mentioned in the conclusion, and the erudition in the progression of ideas that allows for the kind of nuanced epigraphs that start the book, The Learned Hand, Iris Murdoch, as well as the chapters Lionel Trilling has mentioned, to John Stuart Mill, Hannah Arendt, John Hicks, Charlotte Bronte, and James Madison. And while epigraphs and vignettes are just rhetorical devices, really, in lesser hands, my point is just that you've set the stage for really your more developed lines of reasoning within the contents of the five main chapters, which I'd like to ask you about now, starting with the first, free actions and free persons. Why is the first chapter a key to your broader argument? Can you give us a sense of the conceptual clarity you claim to gain by treating freedom not as a property of one's actions, but rather as a property of persons? What does that mean? And what's the advantage here in terms of a liberal conception of free actions and free persons, as you've titled the chapter? And again, I realize there's a lot there. Don't expect you to, give us an answer in 10 words or less.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for the generous words. I'm grateful for that. So the big move that chapter one makes, as the title of the chapter suggests, is to get us to think about freedom as a property, not of actions, but of persons, which actually is the more traditional way of thinking about freedom as a political value in the history of political thought. So what I'm trying to do really is get away from what I think of as a kind of unhelpful way of thinking about freedom, which is to start by asking the question, well, to what extent am I constrained? Freedom means me not being constrained. Freedom means me being able to do more things. In other words, freedom is a question of the actions, or a function of the actions that I'm able to perform. And that strikes me as a kind of conceptually unhelpful way of starting a conversation about freedom, first of all, because we're always constrained in whatever we do. So what one has to do in that sort of framework of thinking is to stipulate that certain kinds of constraints just don't count as freedom reducing, maybe unintentionally imposed constraints or non-human imposed constraints, or, you know, constraints that one has a right to impose, or things like this, sort of ad hoc limitations on what the word constraint can properly mean from a political point of view. And then on the other hand, of course, actions aren't all created equal. You know, as the philosopher Charles Taylor pointed out, traffic lights constrain my freedom, and so do bans on practicing my religion. But of course, my inability to cross an intersection whenever I want is nowhere near as significant as my ability to worship as I please. So we have to make qualitative distinctions among the actions we're able to perform in order to think properly about what freedom means. And the kind of action-centered way of thinking, to my mind, doesn't really do a very good job of making those kinds of distinctions. So what does it mean to think about freedom from the standpoint of persons? Well, again, in history of political thought, the word freedom as a political value referred to a status that a person held. So to be a free person was to be a citizen, to have some sorts of claims to consideration and to having a voice in determination of how public affairs were going to be run, to have a kind of status among one's other free peers. And of course, in pre-modern times, to have a kind of position to be able to dominate unfree people, slaves, women, working class people, the poor, foreigners, and so on. So freedom meant having a privileged social status and the kind of rights and responsibilities that went with holding that status, and wasn't simply a function of sort of how many things you were able to do, how unconstrained you were. In fact, the ethical constraints that came with free status were quite constraining often. So I'm playing with that Republican kind of having a voice in the collective control of one's affairs, self-government, if you like. That's one kind of person-centered conception of freedom that's important from a liberal point of view. And the challenge in the modern period is the extension of that Republican form of citizenship in principle to all adult people, which sort of changes the face of things in a lot of interesting ways, which I can talk about later if you're interested. But I'm coupling that with another kind of privileged status that a person can hold, which is the privilege of not being responsible for what you do. The privilege, as I say, in a market to impose costs on other people without their having any say in the matter, to raise the price of certain goods, to fire somebody, to express opinions that they find offensive or disturbing, to criticize them in the ways that they may find uncomfortable. So market freedom, in kind of the broad sense in which I talk about it, consists in this ability to impose costs on other people, which is a privileged status that we grant to people in various domains, always limited, but which is no less a matter of sort of social privilege than the privilege of being a kind of equal citizen. So it's really, to my mind, we're always constrained in what we do. And the question is the nature of the constraints that we face something that we sort of take collective responsibility for, say in the form of law or public regulation or whatever, or are the constraints these sort of more informal, unregulated constraints that we impose on each other whenever we act as social creatures? The constraint that I know that if I do X, the people around me will react to that in a certain way, and I shape what I decide to do based on my expected costs and benefits of acting or not acting in a certain way. That's no less a constraint than the constraint. Sometimes it's a more powerful constraint than the constraints that law may impose on. So either way, I'm constrained. And the question is, what status do I hold? Do I hold the status of somebody who can sort of have a say in how those constraints function? Or is my status simply to be able to act as I please and other people bear the costs as they fall?
Yeah, it's an interesting distinction. As much as I resist proceeding linearly through chapters, in this case, I think it works, given the way you've laid things out. Chapter two, and again, you may feel you can kind of dance around what you've already shared with us, but chapter two is titled Republican Freedom. It looks at the relationship you understand well, of course, that of Republican freedom and the market. And in it, you do this through the work of the political philosopher Philip Pettit. This is an interesting chapter, especially for listeners who may be familiar with Pettit's work, including some of his more recent, such as Just Freedom and On the People's Terms, a Republican Theory and Model of Democracy. Just as an aside, but what amounts, I think, to significant recognition of your second book, The Invention of Market Freedom, Pettit references it in Just Freedom as the go-to source, right, for the history of Republican attitudes to markets. So well done there. And you really are in some good scholarly company, or significant scholarly company, I should say, from Amartya Sen to Gerald Cohen to Martha Nussbaum and James Coleman, among others. So let me ask you, what is it about Pettit's work? And you had mentioned him early on, but what is it about his work on the concept of freedom and Republican thought that you find useful for your argument in this book, and that's distinct in its own right?
Yeah, so I mean, it's funny. Chapter two is in many ways a critique of Pettit, but I should acknowledge, as you suggest, an enormous debt to Pettit, because it's really his ideas that got me thinking along these lines in the first place. So it's, and he's, as you say, generously cited my own work in his more recent books. So Pettit, like me, holds a person-centered conception of freedom, where freedom means a kind of security against arbitrary interference on the part of other people. So freedom is a kind of status one holds that allows one to look other people in the eye without fear, without deference, without having to sort of cringe and bow and censor oneself because one fears the kind of repercussions that might result if one stepped out of line. So I think the real power of Pettit's view is to get us to recognize that there's forms of interference in a person, forms of constraint on action that can be, as he says, non-dominating, non-freedom reducing, which are the forms in which we have some say, some control over what form those constraints take. And there's forms of non-interference that can be dominating. There's cases where I can not be literally constrained, but be under the threat of constraint from a dominating actor. I can fear that if I, you know, did X, my boss or my spouse or the government or whatever would sanction me in a way that I can't control. And therefore sort of preemptively censor myself, my own actions, maybe my own character, are fundamentally distorted by the presence of that dominating or arbitrary power. I find that to be a really powerful way of thinking about freedom, again, because it places the focus on this status that one holds or doesn't hold of being protected or shielded from the practice of arbitrary power or domination. So the question I raise in chapter two is, do markets dominate us in that sense? Pettit argues that markets don't dominate us in that sense because markets are sort of non-intentional institutions or non-intentional actors. So when markets constrain us, nobody in particular is constraining. It's just a sort of the outcome of these forces that that nobody controls or directs. And so the feeling of being dominated by a market isn't the same as the feeling of being dominated by a person, because there isn't the sort of personal or interpersonal dimension to it. I argue to the contrary, and other people have argued this as well, that markets do dominate us because the kind of salient feature of domination is this vulnerability. And even though markets themselves aren't intentional agents, the decision to allow a market to make a person vulnerable is an intentional decision. We allow or don't allow markets to operate in certain domains as a matter of public policy. We regulate markets to a greater or lesser extent as a matter of public policy. And so when an individual finds themselves in a market and vulnerable and fearful of what the market might, so to speak, do to them, that is a decision that's been made by an intentional agent, a government or whatever, to allow that kind of vulnerability to exist. So I take it to be a matter of public concern from a Republican point of view, whether markets exist and to what extent they're allowed to and under what conditions they're allowed to operate. So the kind of bottom line conclusion of chapter two is, yes, markets dominate, but the effort to eliminate or overregulate markets would bring other important social costs. And so again, from a liberal point of view, and this is where I break with the Republican point of view, which treats non-domination as the kind of maxim and as the kind of sole or primary political value, I say, no, there are these two political values that are in tension. There's the value of non-domination, the value of Republican freedom. And then there's the value of market freedom, the value to be released from the demands or the responsibilities of collective control over social outcomes.
It kind of leads or transitions nicely to the next chapter, in which I feel like the political economist in all of us should find chapter three, market freedom. Its title, of particular interest. And while some may disagree with its implications, the argument is a key support for liberal freedom's broader framework and orientation. And in some respects, I feel like it brings us back to language and meaning in terms of the definition of what constitutes a market in the first place. Can you talk to us about the role of this chapter and how it supports your person-centered conception of freedom?
Yeah, so really the key claim of chapter three, which maybe I haven't clearly articulated in the conversation so far, is that markets, in my sense, are not only or even necessarily primarily commercial markets. And this is where my own terminology is kind of new and maybe confusing to some readers. So a market for me is just any domain of behavior in which people aren't held publicly or collectively responsible for the consequences of what happens. So, you know, public debate or even a private debate is a market in my sense. Traffic patterns are a market in my sense. Child rearing, family reproduction, all that sort of thing is a market in my sense. Domains of behavior, in other words, in which people make decisions about what to do in the face of social constraints, as I've said, but in a way in which nobody in particular is held responsible for what the ultimate consequence will be. So market ends up being a much broader term, much more all-encompassing term for non-responsible action. And the question is, why do we permit these non-responsible domains of behavior to exist? Why do we permit people to impose costs on other people without their having any say in the matter? And in a way, the heart of chapter three is this sort of long section in the second half where I lay out 16 possible reasons, 16 different possible reasons that one might have for allowing non-responsible choice in a given domain, some of which will be familiar to people who are familiar with like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, defenders of commercial markets, but some of which don't have anything to do with that defense. And so the question of how markets are regulated and when markets are allowed to exist in the first place really is a matter of which reasons we think we have for allowing markets to operate. And those reasons are many and complicated, complementary sometimes, conflicting and sometimes. And so the question of, again, whether and when markets exist is a kind of complicated question, which is something that's appropriately a matter of public debate.
Well, thanks for talking a bit about that and mentioning your 16 thesis posted on the church.
Right.
Anyways, so kidding about that. So chapter four, titled the liberal tradition, I think will be read closely and with much interest, given its application of the freedoms, both Republican and market, as liberal freedom describes them. And in a way, or I guess more than just in a way, it is kind of an origin story, so to speak, of liberalism. Can you explain a bit about how you describe the collapse of the traditional hierarchies and the rise of equality? And then what is meant in terms of democratization, industrial capitalism, and our selective narratives of liberalism's intellectual history? And again, I know there's a lot there. You can work with it as you see fit.
Yeah, so this is getting back to what I said before about what I think of as a kind of mistaken understanding of the liberal tradition that rises out of this kind of Rawlsian contractarian point of view, according to which the founding liberal was John Locke, and the kind of key liberals are Locke, Kant, and Rawls. And sort of people who don't fit that contractarian paradigm very well, like Tocqueville or Mill or Isaiah Berlin or whatever, kind of hold an uncertain position. And to me, that gets things exactly backwards. Again, the first thinkers to call themselves liberals were writing in the early 19th century. There's a continuous strand of liberal thinkers that runs from the beginning of the 19th century through the middle of the 20th century who disagree on a lot of things, sort of self-consciously working within a common tradition, responding to each other, building on each other's ideas, and so on. So the key claim of chapter four is that the motivating problem that brought liberalism into existence was, as you just mentioned, the collapse of social hierarchies over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries. And it's easy to sort of forget how profound a change this brought about. Monarchies and hereditary aristocracies were overthrown or had their powers dialed back. Political and ecclesiastical authority were separated. Property qualifications for the suffrage were removed. Women were given the suffrage, so you had universal adult suffrage by the middle of the 20th century. Slavery is abolished. Colonies win their independence. Democracy goes from being a kind of term of abuse to being a kind of basic test of political legitimacy. All of that happens in a kind of 100-150-year period and just profoundly reshapes the political landscape. And liberalism was an effort, not the only effort, to respond to that development when suddenly being equal is not a kind of hypothetical premise as it was for John Locke, but an actual kind of real social fact and raised all kinds of real social challenges. So the way I talk about it in the chapters is kind of two separate but overlapping stages. This is kind of stylized. One is what I call democratization. Here I rely heavily on Alexis de Tocqueville, this notion that in democracies as we now have them, political power both becomes harder to control and harder to avoid, because now you have these states that can claim to speak on behalf of the people as a whole, that don't speak on behalf of a privileged class, but on behalf of everyone. And you have this new thing called public opinion and the new organs like mass media and so on, a public opinion that, as both Tocqueville and Mill said, have a kind of can have a chilling effect on an individual's ability to sort of think and speak for themselves. So this is what motivated earlier liberal thinkers to try to emphasize the importance of carving out a social space and creating the social conditions, the social infrastructure that makes it possible for there to be pluralism, diversity, innovation, and so on. So their commitment to a kind of free economy, their commitment to a robust pluralistic civil society, Tocqueville's work on voluntary associations, for example, and commitment more generally to kind of pluralism and toleration in the public sphere, in domains of religion, philosophy and ideas more generally. So that's kind of the first move, is this recognition of democracy as both this sort of opportunity and this challenge to social progress. And then the second thing, of course, is the rise of industrial capitalism starting in the 19th century, which again, liberals were at first enthusiastic supporters of because they saw it as a kind of way of getting past the constraints of feudalism, but quickly came to recognize starting around mid-century that it also proposed profound challenges to individual freedom and indeed individual well-being. It's easy to forget how terrible life was for factory workers and others in the early decades of industrial capitalism. And so here you see liberals deploying the idea of freedom to defend a lot of things that are completely familiar to us now, you know, the kind of socialization of essential public infrastructure, roads, utility systems, communication systems, and so on. Social insurance programs for unemployed people, for the elderly, for disabled people, of course, regulation of production, of workplace conditions, consumer safety regulations, regulations on conditions of work like minimum wage, maximum hours laws. This is the period when you get free and compulsory schooling for children, so people are you know, educated and not vulnerable to domination out of a kind of lack of education. You get antitrust laws, pro-union laws. You get progressive income tax, all of these sorts of policies come in the sort of second half of the 20th century, the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, as a way of creating, the conditions of self-government, the conditions of responsible choice in the face of this new economic challenge that industrial capitalism posed. And so John Stuart Mill is an early person to be thinking about these things. And then the British social liberals, T.H. Green, L.D. Hobhouse, J.A. Hobson, others, and of course, John Dewey in the United States. All are kind of using liberal ideas to respond to this challenge of vulnerability and subjugation that people were experiencing as a result of industrial capitalism and the kind of new economic conditions of life in that period. So that's a kind of two-step where first liberals are emphasizing carving out a space for individual choice again, and on the other hand, recognizing a need for public regulation where there hadn't been such so strong a need before. And liberalism has always sought to balance these two things. And that's, again, kind of the heart of the book, is to show that even the most socialistic liberals still recognize the value of individuality. And even the most individualistic liberals recognize the need for some kind of public regulation to put some guardrails on what can happen to people.
And you mentioned that tension in a few places. Well, you bring the argument back to the present moment in chapter five. Chapter five is liberalism and the problem of polarization. Can you make the case for us, hey, why a freedom-centered liberalism, and I realize you've been doing that already, is the best response to polarization in terms of the tools it offers, and how then you differentiate between authoritarians and utopians, and where this may leave us?
Yeah, so polarization arises obviously from disagreement, and the question of politics really is how do we manage disagreement? How do we turn it in constructive directions as opposed to non-constructive directions? And so chapter five is really an effort to take some of the critiques of liberalism that are prominent in the public sphere now and really have been prominent since liberalism first existed. And try to show how the freedom-centered liberalism that I develop over the course of the book does a better job of responding to those critiques than the justice paradigm, as I call it in the introduction, that started with Rawls does. And really, again, the heart of it, as I've said a couple of times, is to recognize that if we're always striking a balance and never completely satisfying, certainly never a completely fixed balance between these two values, which I hope that everybody can in some sense recognize and embrace, then there's created a kind of space for dialogue, for change over time, for constructive engagement across lines of disagreement that doesn't exist when you start from the premise that, well, I know what justice requires, and if you disagree with me, then then you should be, if possible, silenced, which is, to my mind, a kind of fundamentally authoritarian way of thinking about politics. Mm-hmm. So that's really the work that chapter is trying to do in broad strokes.
Well, there's so much more that we could talk about, including the politically engaged key thinkers that are central to your argument in Chapter 4, Constant, Tocqueville, Mill, Green, Hobhouse, Hobson, Dewey, you've mentioned them. Let's save this for a more in-depth discussion, I suppose, of liberal freedom for another day. So listeners can gain a better understanding of your arguments, progression, and sources, and how, in parts, you've built upon the research in your second book, The Invention of Market Freedom. So you have kind of a trilogy here of book material, and we've not even talked about your journal articles or their focus, which leads me to this kind of awkward way of asking, hey, what are you working on these days?
Yeah, well, I've been thinking about freedom kind of nonstop for about 15 years now, and I finished this book and decided it was time to think about something else for a bit. So right now I'm working on two shorter pieces that are a bit afield from the themes of this book. One is a piece on Herman Melville, actually, the novelist, and nice. The role of Thomas Hobbes's ideas in his posthumously published novella Billy Budd Sailor, which has been really fun to sort of dive into Melville himself and to the literature on Melville. And I think I'm onto something in terms of what his influences may have been, what ideas he was working with in writing that famous and politically interesting novel, Billy Budd. And that, as I said, Hobbes has a kind of key role to play in the background of that story. And then less far along is another sort of shorter piece I'm working on John Locke's use of the figure of Jephthah, and then the appeal to heaven by Jephthah in the Book of Judges, at a sort of key moment or a couple of key moments in the Second Treatise on Government. So as I say that out loud, I realize I'm writing two pieces about contractarian thinkers, having written a critique of contractarianism. So maybe this is some kind of penance. And then in the back of my mind, I have a book on democratic theory in mind, sort of on the question of whether democracy can be justified in part because it's a good way of getting at, so to speak, the right answers. There's a kind of epistemic value, as people say, to democracy. And, you know, I'm skeptical about the idea that that's the best way to think about justifying democracy, but I don't quite know what I think, which is why I want to write a book about it and kind of, you know, figure out what I think in the course of writing, which is sort of how I usually go about writing books. Nice. So those are the three things I guess I would mention in terms of what's on my table at the moment.
Sure. And all sound interesting. Really do strike me as more intellectual historian, and hope we can discuss more down the road. Your current book, Liberal Freedom, draws on many primary and secondary sources. Do you have a few book recommendations for listeners interested in complementing your intellectual and historical approach to the study of liberalism and the concepts of political theory more broadly?
Yeah, it's hard to narrow down. I mean, everything sort of leads to everything else, and there are so many important figures and thinkers who have shaped my thinking on these issues. I mean, I guess I'm tempted to sort of name three pairs of books, which, depending on a listener's interest, might, you know, appeal to them for different reasons. So the first pair is two pairs of books by sort of contemporary political philosophers. You've already mentioned Philip Pettit, who, as I've said, is sort of the reason why I got interested in these ideas in the first place. Probably the best place to start for his ideas is his recent book, Just Freedom, which is the title contains a kind of double entendre that we should just be thinking about freedom when we think about politics, and that freedom, as he understands it, gives rise to a kind of idea about justice. So I think Just Freedom by Pettit is a nice, crisp introduction to his point of view. And then a kind of complementary book to that, which is more compatible with my thinking about markets and freedom, is Elizabeth Anderson's book, Private Government, which is about domination that people experience in the workplace and the kind of invisibility of that domination to contemporary politics and some extent in contemporary political philosophy. It's a really nice, again, a crisp book that shows both how markets can be liberating and how markets, as they kind of be understood in the later 20th century, are in many respects dominating. Really sharp books. That's for the political philosophers in the audience. For the historians of political thought, I'm tempted to recommend sort of two classics. One is, I mean, your listeners, I'm sure, know Mill's book On Liberty, which is a great book. I think to get a sense of a broader sense of Mill's thought and the kind of his efforts to think through the challenge of the 19th century, his book, Considerations on Representative Government, which appears 2 years later, is in a way a better introduction to his ideas. You just will find things they don't like in there. There's Mill's qualified defense of colonialism, which also appears in On Liberty, gets a chapter. More Votes for Educated People gets a chapter. But I think if you look at it as a kind of historical document of how a smart and thoughtful person was trying to think through the social and political challenges of his own time and place from a kind of freedom-centered and liberal point of view, it's a good document of what the sort of state of play in 1861. And then something 50 years later, L.T. Hobhouse, a less well-known book, just called Liberalism, which is a nice statement of the kind of social liberal position of the early 20th century. Relatively short and very readable, and I think very contemporary in a lot of ways. So that's for the kind of historians of political thought in the audience. And then from a kind of more popular standpoint, two books I really liked and cite in my book. Adam Gopnik's book, 1,000 Small Sanities, is a nice, Gopnik is, which we'll know, writes for the New Yorker, among other venues, and wrote a really wise, popular book about the kind of achievements of the liberal tradition and the value of liberalism in the kind of polarized political environment we find ourselves in. I found it a very congenial book. And then the historian Helena Rosenblatt has a book called The Lost History of Liberalism, which is a kind of more of an intellectual history, overlapping in large part with what I do in chapter 4 of the book, that starts as I do in the early 19th century and kind of shows the common threads and the complexities of the liberal tradition as they work themselves out from kind of the early 19th century to the present day. That's a lot of recommendations. I apologize.
No, I appreciate the pairing aspect of it. You really took that to heart. That's nice. So thanks so much for that. So I mentioned the epigraph from Lionel Trilling's The Liberal Imagination that you opened your introduction with. That quote worked well on a number of levels, and I wish there were time to talk a little bit more about some of your other epigraphs as well. In lieu of, though, as a kind of epigraph dedicated to your open and thoughtful-minded approach, as evidenced by the scholarship in Liberal Freedom, I want to extend your Trilling quote from his 1950 preface, which reads, "We cannot very well set about to contrive opponents who will do us the service of forcing us to become more intelligent, who will require us to keep our ideas from becoming stale, habitual, and inert. This we will have to do for ourselves." This is, in part at least, what I think you've done. And if there were a research gap for a kind of Trilling requirement of overcoming stale ideas, then I think you've filled that gap with your engaging approach to reasserting freedom as the primary value of a liberalism reconceived. Polarized times or not, this book should be welcomed by all parts of our fractured liberal polity in terms of, as your introduction's Trilling epigraph put it, in putting under some degree of pressure these liberal ideas and assumptions of the present time. So my point is, I guess, that those interested in the history of political ideas and the concepts associated with liberty and really cracking the code of liberalism would do well to pick up Eric McGilvray's Liberal Freedom, Pluralism, Polarization, and Politics, published this year by Cambridge University Press. Professor Eric McGilvray, political scientist, theorist, and intellectual historian, thank you for spending so much time with us. It really was a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Keith. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.